Welcome to the Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs and tastemakers from the worlds of art, culture, tech, and of course, food. I'm Hesham Montasser, founder of The Lighthouse. I'm honored to be joined in today's episode by Chef Daniel Belud, who was recently in Dubai to open his first restaurant in the city, the Belud Brasserie at the Sofitel Obelisk in Wafi City. So we set up our mics under the long crystal chandelier, surrounded by mirrored walls, ceiling, and marble floors. You'd be forgiven if you felt like you were in the middle of New York City for a minute.
What an honor. And welcome to Dubai.
Thank you. Couldn't be a better welcome than with you.
Thank you very much. It's very kind. And thank you for a lovely and delicious dinner last night.
Thank
you. Enjoyed ourselves very much. Chef Belud's career is nothing short of illustrious, of course. Starting out as an apprentice at just 14 under chef Gérard Nandron at the two Michelin star Nandron in Lyon, moving to Copenhagen at just 21 to work at the Plaza Hotel before moving to Washington, D.C. in the early 80s. This then led to him becoming a true entrepreneur with the launch of his flagship, Danielle, which celebrated 25 years in New York in 2018. Since then, he has co-founded the Dynex Group, which oversees operations with more than 900 employees from Vancouver to Beijing. Personally, I remember evenings at Café Belud in New York and London's Mayfair with great fondness and amazing memories. And isn't that what a good restaurant is all about? As the late Deborah Kletter would say, taste always has a memory. And on top of all these amazing achievements, he's a fascinating personality. And perhaps nothing showcases this better than how he celebrates his birthdays. Danielle might be a few years away from his 70th birthday, but you can almost hear a metaphorical skip in his step as he fondly remembers his milestone birthdays over the last three decades, starting, of course, with his 50th in 2005. They had a party for you.
Well, yeah, I had a big party. I had many good parties in my life. I had many good parties.
My research revealed a 50th birthday party.
I tell you, my 40s birthday party in New York, my 50s birthday, and my 60s birthday.
Now I'm jealous.
They were amazing.
Oh, wow, okay.
My 40s, there was a nightclub owner who every night was eating at Danielle.
Wow.
And I turned 40s in 95. And he said, Danielle, I know your birthday is coming. I'm giving you my nightclub. And so DJ, everything.
Which nightclub was it?
Free booze. It was the Palladium.
Ah, the Palladium.
And there was the Michael Todd rooms.
Yes, I remember it.
The Michael Todd rooms.
Oh, my God.
So I had 250 friends, you know. I mean, that was okay.
Not bad for a 40th.
That was good. And everything free, the DJ, the booze.
Fantastic.
Jacques Torres made me a cake who was like 10 feet tall.
Wow.
And then my 50s, a friend of mine bought at auction, because at the time I was doing a fundraising at Danielle for City Meal on Wheel every year. And he bought a dinner for 12 with Robert Parker and his wine. For 12 people at Danielle, and 12 course meal,
wow.
12 wine from Robert Parker and all
wow.
that. And he pays $30,000 for that. And my friend say, a very big wine collector, good friends, good customer, he say, you know, Danielle, this is your birthday party. You can invite another 12 friends.
Wow.
So now we are 24 people, and all the other friends of that friend invited was kind of good customers and friends, including Robert Parker. But then he said, no, we don't want the wine of Robert Parker. I'm going to bring the wine. And the youngest wine was maybe 1970. The oldest wine was 1870
wow.
or 90.
That must have been some night.
1889. And we drank 24 people. We drank 85 bottles. There were a lot of magnums and all that. The dinner lasted 6 hours.
Oh, my God.
And
you're still standing.
And we had 16 courses
wow.
made by 16 of my chefs who used
wow.
to work for me or has worked for me.
How
so
special.
I invited all my alumni to come and cook for my birthday. And
amazing.
It was the party of the century.
Wow.
Because every chef made a platter. I say, I don't want you to give me a little degustation thing.
Yes,
you're
I want
gonna
real
make,
food.
You're going to make me real food. And then my 60th birthday, my wife, Catherine, took care of it and transformed Danielle into Casino Royale. And I had a good amount of friends and good amount of fun too.
I'm coming to the 70th. Please mark the date.
But the best gift was from my partner, Joel Smilo. When I turned 50, he gave me $100,000 and he said, do some good with it. And from that, every year I use first the profit I was making on this money I put in a bank and with the money manager. I put that money aside and I was using the profit. And then after slowly, I mean, some years was not so good, but I was using also the principal. And every year I was sending one of those young kids, underprivileged, who came from these underprivileged college, high schools. And I was sending him to Lyon at the Ecole Paul Bocuse for 3 months. And, you know, I was doing a little competition with 3 or 4 of them selected because they made a good presentation. And from there, I was giving them a subject like chickens and chicken and like maybe a classical application of a chicken and or a fish or something. And then the one who came out with the best dish and the most close to creativity and yet, you know, connection with the classic application, win the prize. And I continue to do that as long as I could with the money, and then after continue to do that with the with myself.
That's wonderful.
So to me, that was a gift who had value because it kept giving. It kept giving, it kept giving for years and years and years.
I'm going to pick a point in your career and start there, and then we'll move around. You had already made a name in France for yourself. You had worked with a number of Michelin chefs, restaurants, to some extent. What made you decide to leave France, given the prominence of France in the culinary industry?
I wasn't planning to go to Denmark or anywhere out of France. I started an apprenticeship in Lyon for 3 years. And then from there, I went 2 years with Georges Blanc. So the apprenticeship was a two-star in Lyon-Nandron. Then 2 years in Georges Blanc, two-star in Vonnaz before he got the three-star. And I went to Roger Verger, who just got three-star. I asked Georges Blanc, I said, can you help me get a job there? And right away, he called. And 6 months later, I had a job at the newest three-star in France, the Moulin de Mougins. After my 2 years, you know, you go and sit down with the boss and have a little recap and interview. And I told him, I said, you know, I would like to go back to Lyon and I would like to go to Alain Chapelle or I would like to go to Trois Gros or a 3-star around the region. And he said, oh, Daniel, I have a better idea. I mean, why don't you go to Copenhagen? Because he was a consultant there. He was doing the menus for an hotel, which was fantastic. It was Tradition et Qualité, which is Les Grandes Tables du Monde, some of the best chefs in the world and all that. And also Relais Chateau. The hotel was the Plaza Hotel in Copenhagen. And the owner of the Plaza Hotel in Copenhagen had also the Søllerød Kro, which was just outside of Copenhagen, beautiful old Danish inn. He had Kong Frederik Hotel and a group of hotels and restaurants, and also La Maison du Danemark in Paris, right on the Champs-Élysées. So very, very familiar with France, very dear friend of Roger Verger, and Roger Verger was the consultant. So he asked me, Daniel, would you go and represent me there?
So said yes.
I was 21 years old,
why
and
not?
No attachment to any love affair or anything. So I just went to Copenhagen and, of course, fell in love every 5 minutes there. But Copenhagen at the time was right at the end of the mid to late 70s. And you could really see already the impact of Nouvelle Cuisine happening there and the rise of local chef, the rise of local talent already. And that was a very exciting time, I think, in Copenhagen. It was way, way, way pre-René Redzepi and the Scandinavian movement. And same in Sweden and same in Norway. And they were already this sort of little circuit of great restaurants and great great place.
So the idea was clearly planted in your head, even though you grew up both in Lyon and in France in general, in a place that obviously celebrates food, known for its culinary excellence, to move to Copenhagen, and from there you wind up landing on the Upper East Side.
Well, I was in Copenhagen, so I go to Michel Gerard. I come back to Copenhagen because I love that city, and I really felt that I felt good there. I took a lot of responsibility. I was starting to get great contact, but I wanted to leave the hotels. I meet this very young restaurateur, Jan Hurtikal. That was his first business. So imagine, very artistic, very free mind, and good background, but maybe not like me. But together, we opened his first restaurant. And so it was really like one of those, you know, when I see sometime today, young chef in Brooklyn opening their little edgy place, which is a little artsy,
yeah.
Didn't spend much money, but the food is amazing,
yes.
And all that. And that was very much like that. And I did that for almost a year with Jan, and that was fantastic. And then a friend of mine reached out to me and say, I have been given a job in Washington as a private chef to an embassy, the European Economic Community, but I don't want to go. I have three kids, and would you like to go? And so I met the ambassador in Europe, and I decided to go to Washington.
And of course, the moment you got to Washington, you were like, this is not it. I have to move to New York, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, so I arrived in Washington, and there, when I was at Michel Gerard, there was this young chef in the region, very young. His name was Jean-Louis Paladin. And Jean-Louis Paladin was the youngest two-star chef in France. I think he was 27 when he got his two-star or something. And he moved to D.C., to Washington. So I arrived maybe almost barely a year after he moved into Washington, and he opened the restaurant Jean-Louis. So I felt already arriving in Washington, there was a connection with French fine dining. And while in America, all those French restaurants was kind of like from the 60s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s.
100%.
Jean-Louis Paladin was like right on with his tasting menu. He was writing his menu every day based on the market. He was going to the market all the time. He was teaching people how to raise squab, how to raise duck, how to raise lamb and vegetables and herbs. And so he was really engaging with the local and creating the model for what America became in terms of fine dining after. And I felt that, you know, I want to stay here for a while and try to, you know, practice in the restaurant business. And I moved to New York for that. I didn't want to stay in D.C. I love New York.
You understood that New York was essentially at the epicenter of all of that, obviously.
Yes, and also I love the energy of New York. I love the power of New York. I love the complexity and also the diversity of New York. And
speaking of power, you landed at a restaurant that was at the epicenter of power at the
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah.
It was the place.
Absolutely.
We used to have what they call power lunches, which, yes, they still do, but maybe less so. Less
so,
Wall Street people.
Absolutely. I was in two hotels there. Arriving in New York, I worked with Trostas Forte, which at the time was the largest hotel group in the world. They had, you know, the Georges V in Paris, the Plaza Athénée, the Savoy, the Claridge's, and all those great hotels. I did maybe 3 years with them. And I had enough with hotel, and I went to the most iconic restaurant in New York at the time, Le Cirque. And Le Cirque, everybody looked at me like, oh, this one is going to butt his nose on the thing. He's never going to make it. He don't know what it is to be one of those French iconic restaurant in New York where, you know, it was really a thing from the past, and yet
100%.
The owner was trying to evolve with the present.
But you must have understood that.
I think what I understood is that I had a very good background as a classically trained chef. So I understood the cuisine they were trying to do.
Yeah.
I felt that it wasn't that good, frankly. Like, you know, it don't matter if you do a bouillabaisse or if you do a tripe, a braised tripe, or if you do any classic dishes. There is a way to do it ordinary, and there is a way to do it, you know, extraordinary. And I felt that if I could elevate the classic already, so people are not disoriented, the customer are not disoriented, and everybody see the difference, even, you know, a pot-au-feu. So a pot-au-feu is boiled meat and vegetable. When I introduced the pot-au-feu I was making, it was not just a little pot with a bunch of cut meat and vegetables and a good broth. It was a marmite like this with seven different meats and vegetables and 12 different condiments. And I wanted to elevate that to
the level.
Exactly, to the highest of what gastronomy could be when you do a classic dish. For me, it was natural to be there, but I also was innovating a lot with new dishes who became new classic, such as the famous popiette of sea bass wrapped in crispy potatoes on the bed of leek with a red wine sauce, or the sea scallop black tie who, the minute we made that dish, never left the menu. And even when I left Le Cirque, it always stayed there.
And walk us through that very important point in your career where you obviously must have had the confidence to think, I can put my own name behind a restaurant. Now, I want to just pause here because you didn't do it in a way some chefs maybe do. They have built a name, a reputation. They lend their name to a restaurant group. You did not do that. You started your own business. That's a very big transition. And you started your own business in New York, on the Upper East Side, highly competitive place. If you don't make it, essentially, people will know immediately, and your career can be killed.
Absolutely.
So walk us through your thinking at the time.
First, after 4 years, 5 years at Le Cirque, I had a baby girl, okay. Alix, my daughter, and now she's 30-some.
Fantastic. 31. She also in food?
No.
Okay.
But she lives in Washington, D.C.,
interestingly,
where I all started.
Interesting, okay.
New York in the late 80s was rough.
Yes.
It was really rough.
Crime.
Yes, absolutely. And I felt like, is there my chance to go back home and open a restaurant in Lyon? But my parents were farmers. I had no money. What I did is I went to the city hall, to the mayor, to all the people working at the city hall. I was knocking at every door and say, oh, you own this building and you own this beautiful pavilion here and this and that. Why don't we can make a restaurant? You call yourself International City Lyon. Maybe you need an international chef. And I was almost close enough to be able to do it. But the problem was the mayor of Lyon was in a tangle of politics and problems. And no one was making decision. And after a year and a half of trying to go back to Lyon, and then also 89, 90, that was the crisis. That was a crash of 89, Black Friday. And so the New York was shaken. And I decided to stay. And that's when I started to decide to raise money in New York to do that. You know, it was my first business, and I needed $2.5 million. And I felt that if I can find ten investors at $250,000, I would be okay. Little by little, a lot of people say, well, you know, I lost so much money in the crash, then I'm barely recovering. I can't afford to go into the restaurant business. So, but I was very lucky. I had four good friends. One was a lawyer. One was a family friend. One was a real estate broker. And one was, three of them helped me. And one was also in the real estate as well. And Lily, who is still my partner today, is a Harvard graduate. That's why I ask you what year you graduated from Harvard.
I see.
Because I think she graduated in 91.
Okay. She's a little bit ahead of me.
91, 92.
I graduated in 97.
Exactly. So they decided to help me and be my cover-up for all the meetings, the negotiation with landlord, and helping me raise money.
Why would they help you? I'm just curious.
Because we were all very young, and we wanted to kind of help each other.
Different. Sure.
And they wanted me to succeed in my dream. They were all very close friends with my wife.
Did you raise it $2.5 million?
Well, I had about half of the raise. Not even. I didn't even have $1 million yet. But I was meeting the uncle of Lily, who just retired from being the CEO of Playtex. He made a lot of money. He gave a lot of money to hospitals, to research centers, to Yale University there. You know, he has a couple of buildings there at Yale and all that. After an hour conversation, he tell me, say, you know, I know you are trying to raise money. I know that it's not an easy time, but I'd rather be the only partner than one of them.
So he gave you the whole amount?
He said, tomorrow we can start business if you decide, then that's a good thing for you. And wow. He said it will be much easier to do business together, and it'll be much easier to progress together. Joel Smilo was he was very smart. He ran international company on the stock market. Lily was a Harvard graduate. Joel was a Yale graduate. So all of them together guide me quite well in setting up my business and running my business.
So what
but
did you
the
think
success, they don't depend always on the money you have. It's
no, that's exactly my point. What did you think they saw in you? Because raising the money is not easy, but it's not enough. Plenty of people, you know this business better than anyone, raise money, open restaurants, they close. So they must have seen something. Do you have any sense of, any guesses of what they saw in
well,
you at the time?
Well, they knew that I had talent because already at Le Cirque I won 4-star in the New York Times, which was the highest rating. I won Best Chef in New York with James Beard. I won Food and Wine Best New Chef. I mean, and I was just like getting all the award and the recognition already before I left Le Cirque. So that was kind of the foundation. And Joel Smilo at the time say, you know, I couldn't afford to get Michael Jordan, but I got the Michael Jordan of cooking.
I think he was right. When we come back, we'll continue following Chef Boulud's journey as he evolved into a seasoned entrepreneur and investor, how he's decided to pay it forward and give back to his community, and his take on technology and automation in the F&B space. On the other side of this short break. Hi guys, this is Hashim again. I'm excited to share that we've launched our newest concept called Small. It's based on a menu of, well, small indulgent dishes that you can mix and match. And my personal favorite is the Merguez sausage sandwich, which is just divine. So if you're in Dubai, make sure to drop by the food district at the Point and take a bite out of the new Merguez with tahina sauce. You'll find Small among other locally born fabulous concepts like Boon Coffee, Reef Koshiaki, and Sticky Rice. Small is on the first floor of the food district at the Point on Palm Jumeirah, and you can follow us at Small Dubai, SmolDubai, on Instagram, and drop us a line if you stop by and let us know what you thought. Welcome back. You're listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with Chef Daniel Boulud. Before the break, Daniel managed to secure the entire investment he needed to open his flagship restaurant in New York City, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Right away, when we started the restaurant, it went on fire. I mean, it just like
exploded.
And so 3 years later, Le Cirque closed and moved to the Palace Hotel, and they call it Le Cirque 2000. The Mayfair Regent closed and become a condominium. And they approached me and said, Daniel, we want you back there. We want you to move Daniel there, and we want to sell you the real estate as a condominium. Joel Smilo, again, could really be the partner to step up because he decided to bankroll the entire move. So 24 years ago, we bought the real estate, 1,700 square meter, which is 17,000 square foot, is huge, 3 floors. And we had to invest $10 million in it 23 years ago.
Amazing. And this must have given you the sense, because we all know, I mean, a big part of the struggle of restaurants is obviously landlord issues, rent.
Of course. And the risk, the financial risk.
And the financial risk. So you got rid of that very early. Did you feel that enabled you to think long term about Daniel and about the
exactly.
restaurant business?
No, what made me think very long term was that I was going to become a real estate owner at the same time as be a restaurateur. And that I felt, and that will always be my retirement option.
Did George Schmeiler understand that you're also a good businessman? Because obviously you are. So
well, I prove him at the first Daniel that we could be profitable while being
so
the best restaurant in America.
Over. Absolutely. Is he still part of your group?
No, he's retired now.
Okay.
His children have a small stake, and Lily as well.
Plenty of good chefs, great chefs, in fact, are great chefs. That doesn't mean they're good business people. How did you manage those two? I mean, in your business today, you're both. You wear a chef hat and you wear a business hat. You're a CEO of a large company.
Absolutely, and I'm kind of micromanaging as well, so I get involved with everything from PR to HR to to design to the taste of the coffee to everything.
Where did this... Did you always feel you had that in you?
I think the passion... For this business, I really love this business. I love the people working in our business. I think what made me succeed is the people who work with me, of course. Every staff members, we try to really pull the best out of it. And we really try to have them bring the best to the business as well. And taking risk, taking high risk. You know, I had some high and low. Taking risk, I lost a star sometime. I have been in New York now for almost four decades, and I have seen 9 or 10 food critics at the New York Times, and I'm still kind of standing. But I think what saved me the most was the loyalty of my customer, and the loyalty of my staff, and the loyalty of my my partners, and the trust everyone put in, and the community in New York. I think, you know, I've been always part of the community there, and being really made this city my city, and I think that's way you have thing embraced Dubai here and made this city your city. And
And you pay it forward. You've seen, as you said, highs and lows. Inclusive of 9/11, would you consider this to be one of the main lows today?
Of course.
Post-pandemic?
This is much worse than 9/11. Okay. Much worse.
How are you thinking now about your business? I mean, you have people today that are furloughed.
Yeah, 9/11, we had a stop. We had a stop. But then there was a start again. And the start was barely a month after. Within early October, we were starting to see progress. And within the end of the year, tourists was still coming to pay tribute to New York.
Yeah.
People were feeling so connected with New York. And I think we had this amazing support.
Which I remember.
Absolutely. I mean, it was emotionally, everyone was shattered, but at the same time, very, very hopeful. And this power of togetherness was amazing.
What about
amazing.
Today?
Today is just a disaster because in 9/11, I never lost staff. I never furloughed staff. Here, I mean, your most loyal chef, 23 years with you, you have to tell him to go on unemployment and make 20% of his salary.
I mean, for months.
And so right away, I took initiative to try to bring back the talent, the people who I couldn't take it that they could be furlough and unemployment. So we started to do meals in New York. So for
Private
Jose Andres
meals.
With World Central Kitchen, then with City Meal on Wheel, we created a foundation, Food First, to pay businesses to reopen and make meals as well. And that was the first initiative to try to bring back talent and support them. So, you know, we were making meals at $6 a meal or $5.50 a meal, but at least thousands of meals a day were supporting the staff, and we were trying to get also support from suppliers, and to date we have made almost half a million meals.
Amazing.
Gifted to New York, And we continue. When I'm coming back in a week and a half, I have a fundraising for this foundation, Food First Foundation. And I created that with my new partners. I am opening a new restaurant. And for the first time, I'm doing it with a local partner, a real estate partner, in a new development in New York called One Vanderbilt. So it's a basically a $3.5, $4 billion development, one tower, and there'll be only one restaurant inside. It will be called Le Pavillon, and we're opening in March. And with them, we started this foundation with them. He wanted to start a foundation to help some of the businesses he had tenant in his real estate group that he felt terrible for them. So he said, I want to pay my tenant to reopen their kitchen and have a little bit of business.
Will New York come back the way it used to be, in your view? It might take time, but or do you feel there is a rift that is now hard to heal?
No, New York will come back. There has been, you know, people leaving New York. I think the people were very insecure and unstable financially and insecure in their job. I think it was better for them to leave. And some people also weren't secure with the fact of the pandemic in a city.
Of course.
A lot of small companies, some of them wanted to live in smaller cities like, Seattle or Portland, Oregon. But the big financial group, the big motor, the motor of the world, I think the lot of engines are there. And also young people will come back to New York. The way after 9/11, a lot of young people wanted to come.
I was just going to say that. So, I mean, when I speak about New York, and I lived in New York for 5 years, and I consider it, one of the best cities in the world. I grew up in Cairo, which I'm in love with, and I'm equally in love, if maybe more, with New York as well.
I'm due to go to Cairo because Cairo's I have friends there, and I had
fantastic
a long time
city. For... Very different, but similar in the vibrancy and the energy that you have in New York.
Of course.
I'm the only one that goes to New York, as my wife makes fun of me and says that I'm the only one that celebrates that you see trash on the streets. It reminds me of Cairo. I actually don't mind it. It's part of the smells you grew up with. And it's the honking and the... Anyway, so it's fabulous. I think that if anything, this might create an opportunity for younger people to move to New York that couldn't afford it. I mean, New York, meaning Manhattan, had priced out a lot of people. There's a reason there was a move to Brooklyn.
And I think there'll be a reset in a lot of ways for businesses to find better deals between restaurateur and landlord or business and landlord, and also for people living there, for New Yorkers. I think there'll be opportunity to move in, to settle, and to launch business in maybe a better way than the direction it was going. I think this reset will, help.
And you are clearly forward-looking. You are investing in technology. You have set up a company, when I did my research, that looks at robotics within F&B.
It's true.
Cloud kitchens have become a phenomenon that's here to stay, in my view. Tell us a little bit of how, because you come more from a fine dining background, how do you feel technology will impact your business and how will you embrace it? Because clearly you're not running away from it. Other chefs are, by the way. Other chefs are looking away and hoping it goes away. It's not going away.
No. And technology, I mean, there's not a single chef who don't embrace technology, especially in the kitchen. You know, when we had the sous vide era, like 50 years ago when sous vide started, it was like,
revolution.
Out of technology in a way. When induction was coming and when, there's many.
Sure.
Today, technology help you have consistency, speed, precision, and cleanliness and safetiness that maybe sometime you couldn't get before.
Can you see automation running things like potwash and cleaning and maybe
and that'll be nice. I don't know. I mean, not everything, but it definitely helped. Mm. But in the case of spice, for example, I mean, I'm an early investor also in Sweetgreen, which I love this company.
Good concept.
Young
so you're
kids.
A good investor as well.
Well, you know, I'm not a big investor, but I like to bet on little things.
Sweetgreen has done quite well. I would.
I hope it will do well with it sell.
Yes, I'm sure they will. It's a very good concept.
Yeah.
And they have these little what do you call them, pop-ups yes. that they do as well in next to offices.
And they were friends of my daughter and Nicolas Jamet, one of the founders.
Ah, they're
He's
French,
the son.
Right.
Yeah, Father absolutely. They come French of wrestler. French and Americans. And right. and Nicolas Jamet grew up in New York. His parents were the restaurateur who had La Caravelle, Rita and André.
Correct.
And they grew up as children of restaurateur. They went to Georgetown University as student, and
that's where they opened the first Sweet Green.
Exactly, yeah. Because four young graduates of Georgetown Brilliant. Were sick and tired of eating junk and decided to Correct. Open their first salad bar.
I think it's French Lebanese, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, Rita Fantastic. Is more, and Nicolas is French Lebanese
yes,
as well.
Yes.
And Spice is still a young company. It has taken its time to strike.
Can you explain the concept just to our listeners?
So, four young graduates, again, very much like Sweet Green story, mm-hmm. four young graduates of MIT mm-hmm. In Boston.
Not such a great school, in my view. I'm just joking.
Amazing. They sent me a letter. One of them actually is Egyptian, Michael Farid. He sent me a letter, and he said, you know, we are going to be graduating in, I have to recall what year, 5 years ago. We're going to be graduating of MIT, and one of our projects, typical of MIT, kind of cluster of students working together on project, one of our projects is a robotic kitchen. And we have built a mock-up of our ideas. And would you ever be interested to see what we have done? And we would like you to know, we would like you to join us and
Why
give
do
us some
tips. Why do you think they
came
tips. To you?
Because I think Michael was, I think his family took him to Daniel. He knew of Daniel.
Okay.
And
so he
ate as a young kid at Daniel,
okay.
and he remembers. So
okay. yeah.
he approached me, and then I went to Boston, and I go to this little think tank room, one of those pods where they had a little area, and there was this plywood box with some machine cooking and some wires and some tanks of food containers on tubs. And it was all made of recuperation of things and mounted with scotch tape and wires and all that. It made my meal, and I was like blown away. And I felt, well, if they can really develop that into a real
scale
it up. And so it took about 2 years to scale up the first machine. And it took another 2 years to build up version two. And version two was opening, and COVID happened. They were opening at Harvard Square.
I can't wait to go see it.
What the first robotic kitchen could do was about, let's say, 25 steps in the making of a meal based on how you were choosing your meals on the computer. And the bowl was not moving, but there was a track picking up the different element of the meals. And within about not even 2 minutes, a minute and a half, 2 minutes, the meal was ready and falling into a bowl. And the meal is composed of protein, chicken or beef or tofu. The meal was composed of grains also, so rice or frikay or different grains, and also greens and vegetables. And then different sauce from, you know, yogurt to Asians. So there were different style of bowls. And they were warm bowls. And today, the new robot will do about 75 steps. And now the bowl is traveling through under every step.
When you think about a concept like Sweet Green, essentially, it's assembly of food, right? I mean, could
yes.
you see that being automated?
For fast food?
Even healthy food, that's...
Exactly, that's the thing, is that it's healthy.
Yeah.
It's safe. It's well composed.
I mean, Sweet Green is an assembly of various fresh ingredients that you're putting together in a bowl.
Completely. And they...
Doesn't need a human.
And they keep adding... Exactly. Well, yeah, in a sense, but... But today with iPads and
100%.
You pre-order and yeah. all that, it don't matter who make your meal. It's not like the old days salad bar where, you know, you're in front of someone and he put in the bowl what you like.
You pre-order and you go pick it up. Or
you can all do that online.
Yeah.
So I feel that there is a tremendous potential and success. And also with the rise of organic and the rise of hydroponic and combination with organic and with food who are healthy and better controlled, I think it has a huge potential for growth.
Do you consider yourself now American in your heart? Are you a New Yorker or are you
I'm a
French
New Yorker man? First and foremost,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because New Yorker, you can be from anywhere.
100%, that's why I asked.
And yet, so you remain who you are and yet you are a New Yorker.
100%. You have written a number of books. One of them is, I believe, sort of a tribute to young chefs where you give some advice. What is it, because you've done so many things in your life, luckily, and you've been very successful. What are the things that you feel your legacy should be about if you had an ability to shape it?
Of course, and often it's hard to think that you should have only one legacy.
Correct.
And it's hard to think that your life was only geared to build a legacy.
That's very true.
So I think you are unconsciously living your life and doing things who are maybe the foundation of a legacy. But I believe that education was definitely something I invested in, for example, with Thomas Keller and Jérôme Bocuse and 40 chefs in America. We have a foundation called Mentor.
Right.
And we started this foundation with Thomas, and it was really to help young chefs. So we have raised millions of dollars to give back to young chefs to be able to take a sabbatical and take 3 months and choose the chef they want to work around the world. Now we are gearing also to really also support. I have done that with CCAP, which is an organization in America for young kids from more high school. From 16 to 18, with a vocational direction, where a little college or high school was giving cooking class or things like that. CCAP has morphed to other things, but I really look at high school. How can we help a kid 16 years old who has, you know, hard time maybe figuring out what to do and want to choose to become a chef? How can we help them, guide them, and help them succeed the way I succeed? Because without the guidance and the support of my mentor, I would have not been able to be who I am today.
Who do you consider your mentor to be?
Oh, Michel Gérard, Roger Verger, Paul Bocuse, Nandron.
It feels to me you sought out mentors as well. It was an active choice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what I'm trying to tell young chefs, is that, you know, the choice of your mentor will shape your life and shape your career and shape your future as well. I didn't have the opportunity when I was young to work with an amazing Asian chef or amazing Middle Eastern chef or amazing South American chef.
The opportunity is now. You're here in the Middle East.
Exactly.
So we're waiting
for
it.
It's not too late. So
it's not too late at all.
I think if I ever retired one day, I'll go and work for someone. other than me.
And I want to just end it on speaking a little bit about the Middle East and Dubai. You told me off camera before we started that 2008, you and a number of other very well-known chefs had come to the Middle East and thought about doing something in Dubai. It took 12 years, but you're back now.
I know, it's true, and I wish it could have not taken 12 years.
It's fine. I mean, better late than never, as they say.
Very much. And I think this opportunity with Sofitel, they were building this new hotel. We were in touch with them, and they approached us and said, would you ever consider do a brasserie here? We are building a brasserie at the Sofitel, French brasserie. And I felt, you know, this region, for me, has always been an attraction. 13 years ago, I would say 12 years ago, I was coming here already and very, very interested by the demand and by what was happening. I was telling someone that just before I came to America, I was working as a private chef for the summer for a Saudi.
I see.
In Mougins, in a Saudi family in Mougins in Cannes, and I fell in love with the culture of their home, the way they entertain, the way they respected me and made me part of their house.
I'm married to a Saudi, so thank you. I take it as a compliment.
Really?
Yes.
No, but being in France and being in a foreign home and living the culture of it and all that was quite a lesson to me.
And Saudis, I think, I'm probably biased, but particularly hospitable. I mean,
oh yeah, very much.
You go there, you people invite you to their homes.
Very sophisticated, very hospitable, and very caring. And
out of curiosity, was it a family from Riyadh or Jeddah? If you remember,
Jeddah.
Yeah,
I don't know if I
Farah
can say.
Farah is smiling. So she has some roots on the West Coast.
Maybe if
so.
You read my resume, you might find out.
Okay,
who it
I'll was. Find out.
After I moved to America and I met my my wife, Miki, my first wife. You know, we have a daughter together. She's the mother of Alix.
This is your second daughter?
Oh, no, you have a first daughter? I have a daughter, and now I have two young children.
Ah, two young children.
A boy and a girl, Julien and
Gigi. How old are they?
6 and 3.
Oh, my God, wow. I have 9 and 5, so we can compare notes.
Wow, congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
Bring them to New York.
Thank you, inshallah.
Go to the park
inshallah,
together.
For sure.
But interestingly enough, when I married a French-Swiss lady, the father was best friend and business partner and at the time financial advisor to Ahmed Maghrabi.
Oh, yes.
You know
Egyptian.
Ahmed.
Egyptian. I know Ahmed well, yeah.
And Ahmed was actually on Accor in Egypt.
Correct.
Correct.
I think they still do.
And so I was always due to go to Egypt and see the family.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not too late. It's not too late.
I know.
I think Ahmed is in Cairo, if I believe I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. So. But, you know, with the shake-up of the government and the...
Correct.
That was a difficult time.
But I think that's behind them now, luckily.
Yeah.
And they're
very much. But again, he was an amazing supporter. And I had the rehearsal of my wedding. I married in the south of France, and I had the rehearsal of my wedding at his mother's home there in Cannes. And the chef, they were a couple of home cook, but chef from Egypt who was cooking. And he made our meals, and he made this amazing lamb, a braised. So I spent most of my rehearsal wedding dinner in the kitchen to try to understand the lamb.
A braised lamb. Ah, how interesting.
And
was it with molokhea or was it, green broth?
No, not a green broth, but a lot of spice and oranges and
interesting.
And saffrons. And so anyway, the first cookbook I wrote, I called that Leg of Lamb Cleopatra. And maybe you can try the recipe one day.
For sure.
And that recipe was my homage to Egypt and homage to my amazing, unforgettable dinner.
And we're in an Egyptian-inspired hotel as well. So
exactly.
Very, it all comes together.
So it's following me.
Yes. Daniel, thank you for your time, for all the amazing stories. And you should be, I'm sure you are, very proud of yourself.
Thank you, sure.
Your children will be eating many great meals as they grow up, and will be big shoes to fill. And thank you, and welcome to the Middle East. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Inshallah, we'll see you in Egypt as well.
Very happy that you're here to welcome me, and I look forward to see you also in New York.
Yes, absolutely.
And we shall spend more time together.
Yes, thank you.
I want to know more about the Middle East. And,
yes, thank you. And your next stop is in Egypt, hopefully, and I'll come with you.
Exactly. And if someone has the key to the Middle East, you are the one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You're very kind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go visit Boulud Brasserie at the Wafi if you live in Dubai. And of course, when we start traveling again, I highly recommend Danielle on 76th Street in New York City. There's also a link to Chef Boulud's career chronology in our show notes if you'd like to check it out. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Lighthouse Conversations with me, Hesham Montasser.
Our producer is Chirag Desai, and our content director is Farah Sharif. You can connect with us at thelighthouse_AE on Instagram, and you can find all our previous episodes at thelighthouse.ae/podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks.